activities.
Aparimiyani,
immeasurable,
unlimited.
Manasa api, even by such plans perceived,
within the mind.
Asura Ishvarahai, by the controllers of the universe like Brahma and Shiva. Saha Sankarshanaha,
along with Sankarshana Baladev.
Chakre,
performed.
Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Madhusudanaha,
the killer of the Madhu demon.
It's a translation. The Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, with the cooperation of Sankarsana Balarama, performed activities beyond the mental comprehension of even such personalities as Lord Rama and Lord Shiva. For instance, Krishna arranged the battle of Kurukshetra to kill many demons for the relief of the entire world. So you can repeat. The Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, with the cooperation of Sankarsana Balarama, performed activities beyond the mental comprehension of even such personalities as Lord Brahma
and
Lord Shiva.
For instance,
Krishna arranged the battle of Kurukshetra
to kill many demons
for the relief of the entire world. So there's no purport to this text, and we'll read the next text with its purport. Text 61. Kalauja ajanisha mannanam dukkha shukka tamonutam anugrahaya vaktyahanam supunyam jatano yasaha. To show causeless mercy to the devotees who would take birth in the future in this age of Kali. The Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna acted in such a way that simply by remembering him, one will be freed from all the lamentation and unhappiness of material existence. In other words, he acted so that all future devotees, by accepting the instructions of Krishna consciousness stated in Bhagavad Gita, could be relieved from the pangs of material existence. So purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai. The Lord's activities of saving the devotees and killing the demons, Purachunaya, Sadunam, Vinashaya, Chadushkritam, take place side by side. Krishna actually appears for the deliverance of the sadhus or bhaktas, but by killing the demons, he shows them mercy also for anyone killed by Krishna is liberated. Whether the Lord kills or gives protection, he is kind to both the demons and the devotees. So, Omagana Timadanda Shah, Gananjana Shlakaya Chakshur and Meditam Yena Tasmai Shigurveda Maha. So, 2 points here. 1 point is the essential reason that Krishna appears in this material world, and the second point is Krishna's equality to all living entities. And as Prabhupada states in the beginning of the 10th canto and also the Krishna book, that one of the essential reasons, essential means purposes that only Krishna could do. There's non-essential reasons, which are Parichanaya, Sananama, Vinashaya, Chadushkritam, killing the demons, establishing religious principles, protecting the devotees, that Prabhupada said could be done by any of Krishna's energies. Because as we mentioned many times in class before, Krishna's energies are first-class servants of Krishna and also Daivyesha Gunamaya Mama Mahadharajya. No one can overcome, especially Krishna's external energy or any of Krishna's energies. So the essential reasons that Krishna appears, first of all, for his own rasa and enjoyment, but what's being discussed here in this particular verse is to show people who the Supreme Personality of God is. I'm paraphrasing Prabhupada's words, probably use the word iconography, that generally when people are trying to understand the nature of God, if they believe in God, that's the first thing. Good morning. So when people are trying to understand the nature of God, if they believe in God, they generally project their own conceptions upon the Supreme Absolute Truth. That is, they think that God must look like them. And of course, there's this example given by some ancient Greek philosopher that if horses had gods, he would look like a horse. You know, so everybody projects, just like you see in different cultures, they depict Lord Jesus Christ as looking differently. You know, sometimes people depict Lord Jesus Christ as having blonde hair and blue eyes, sometimes curly hair. You know, different ways they depict Lord Jesus Christ because they're projecting their own understanding of their own culture. Actually, Lord Jesus Christ was Semitic, so he did have curly hair. He didn't have long blonde hair. If you look at it genetically, he would not have had long blonde hair and blue eyes. So in any case, apart from that, people like to picture God in their own image. That's called anthropomorphism. Anthropomorphism means that people project their understanding of God and when they draw pictures. Or they think that God must be really old, so they depict a picture of God, like in the Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo's depiction of God being very old. You know, you have that picture of God reaching out to Adam and giving him the spark of life or something like that in the Sistine Chapel. So, really, of course, God is the oldest of the oldest, Purana, old. But still, he is Navayovanamcha. That's the description given in the Brahma Samhita. He's eternally youthful. Now, how do we know he's eternally youthful? Yes, we have the descriptions in the Vedic literatures, and we have the history of those. Those descriptions are based on the history of when Krishna appeared 500 years ago, so he could show us what he looks like. He could show us what he looks like, and he could show us what he does in the spiritual world, and he could show us where he lives. Like Prabhupada sometimes would say, you know, Krishna shows us his name, address, and telephone number. Of course, nowadays we would say Krishna shows us his name, address, mobile phone number, and email address or something, WhatsApp or whatever it is. So, in other words, Krishna shows us exactly the way he is, so we don't have to speculate on him. And then we can become attracted to him. That's what it means, causeless mercy. The devotees would take birth in the future of the age of Kali. Because in the age of Kali, philosophy is just like really not understood too well. Just like yesterday, I was reading some atheist arguments, you know, because part of my job is to show how the atheist arguments against the existence of God are bogus, you know, not logical. So in analyzing these atheistic arguments, I could see that they hadn't even used logic properly. What to speak of, you know, understanding the nature of God, they hadn't even used mundane logic properly. So this is the problem in the age of Kali, that everybody is like unfortunate and manda sumanda matiyo manda bhagyu padrata, short-lived, unfortunate, short memory, and everything like that. So really, people are not going to be able to understand God by any other purpose or any other process. In the other ages, they had other processes, like the Sankhya Yoga process, for example. In the Sankhya Yoga process, that is elaborated on by Lord Kapiladeva, there's the analysis. Sankhya means to count. So in Sankhya Yoga, you're analyzing the different material elements. Of course, the Vedic conception of the elements is earth, water, fire, ether, mind, intelligence, false ego. The eightfold elements. And you also analyze the senses, what the senses, the perceptive senses, the active senses, the objects of the active, of the perceptive senses. Perceptive senses means the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the sense of touch, like that. And so And then eventually you come to the point of understanding, well, that's not where consciousness comes from, so you come, there must be a soul, and then ultimately you understand there must be a super soul by analysis. That's called the ascending process. You know, by analysis, you may come to the point of understanding. You will come to the point of understanding. There's a creator. There's God. I mean, you may not understand his nature by the simple and that analytical process. But, I mean, for example, if by looking at nature itself, the complexity of nature, you can understand it must have been a creator. Anything so complex. I mean, we've been having this discussion on the internet with some people. Like, you have things that are extremely complex, like this human body or one cell in the body. And the complexity is not even understood by the scientists. I mean, they analyze the cell, but they don't even understand. I mean, even like how DNA functions. DNA, is the hereditary function of the cell within the nucleus of the cell. They don't even understand how that functions. I mean, there's a, like, sometimes the DNA strands, or strands of these different proteins, anyways. I'm not going to get into details what it is. But there's little tiny microscopic strands of molecular proteins. Proteins means basically atoms arranged in a molecular function, so they're proteins. There's different types of proteins. And so these strands sometimes become entangled with each other. Just like if you have strings, you know, sometimes, for example, I have a headset for my mobile phone, and I keep it in my bead bag. And every time I take it out, guess what? There's knots in it. I didn't put knots in it. But somehow, isn't it, you wonder sometimes how the knots got in it? I mean, it's just sitting there. And then there's knots in it, and then I have to spend some time unknotting it. So the same thing happens with these little molecular strands. They get knots in them. And what are they going to do? I mean, there's nobody there to just, like, untie the knots. So there's another mechanism in the DNA, or it's not actually part of the DNA, another thing that cuts the strands, because that's one way of untangling the knots, because that's not so good if you do that with your mobile, your headset, because then you're going to have to solder it together. So there's basically a mechanism that cuts them and solders them together again. Not solders them, but connects them together. And it's all a little tiny machine. It's a machine. The body's a machine. And of course, even on that level, there's that machine, that molecule. It's a molecule that does it. Molecule is just like a collection of atoms put together in a certain way. And it does it, you know, molecular machine. And we haven't discovered any normal machine that came about by chance, have we? I mean, there's this typical example that theists use, that if you come across a watch, you know there must be a watchmaker or a machine that made the watch, right? I mean, no watch happened by chance. So the atheists use the argument, well, if you come across a stone, it doesn't mean that there's a stone maker. Well, there's a difference between a stone and a watch. Obviously, the complexity. No one's ever seen a machine that's self-assembled. It just doesn't happen. I mean, you can have a robot that assembles a machine, but someone has programmed the robot. You know, that's happening now. But never a machine that self-assembles. I mean, of course, the organic matter can appear to self-assemble, but somebody's put together the separate machines that appear to self-assemble. Anyway, so therefore we can understand there's God. So in the Sankhya Yoga system, eventually you come to the conclusion that there's God, getting back to the point. There's God. But as far as what is the nature of God, then you'd have to really engage in meditational yoga. And then engage in a this takes a long time. As Krishna says, Mahunam Janmanamante Ganamanam Prapatate Vasudeva Sarvamiti Sa Mahatma Sudrila. It says after many, many births and deaths of this process, then one, Vasudeva, understands Krishna. And such a person is very rare. Sa Mahatma Sudrilabha. There's such a great soul is very rare. So, and also there's a Manushanam Sahasreshu Kastid Yatati Siriye Yatadam Siddhanam Kastid Mam Veti Tadvata. Many, many people, hardly anyone is looking for truth, and all those who are looking for truth, hardly one knows me. You know, so you got this statement. It's very rare to understand Krishna. But in Kali Yuga, we are so fortunate, just before the advent of Kali Yuga, Krishna came, and Krishna showed us what he's like. So therefore, we can directly engage in bhakti yoga. How could you directly engage in bhakti yoga unless you knew what Krishna was like? It would be impossible. Because bhakti yoga means the yoga of devotion. So unless you actually knew what someone is like, how can you gradually develop love of him or her? It's impossible. So therefore, Krishna allows us in Kali Yuga, with our short lives, with our unfortunate intelligence, lack of intelligence in Kali Yuga, to understand him just by hearing these descriptions, historical descriptions. This is history. Practically modern history. It's only 5,000 years ago, a little over 5,000 years ago now. It's not 5,000, it's a little over 5,000. Or what to speak of Lord Chaitanya, 500 years ago. I mean, even that some devotees have come up with this painting of Lord Chaitanya that was done. You seen that painting? Of course, we don't know what it's bona fide, but there's descriptions. There's definitive descriptions of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is the Yuga avatar, or the appearance of Krishna in this Kali Yuga. How he looks, what he did. There's so many biographies. This is modern, you know, 500 or over 500 years ago. It's not 500 anymore. But over, you know, recently, a few years ago, we celebrated the 500th appearance day of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu when I was in the movement. And so this is recent history. You know, people talk about, even in the West, they talk about history that's far more old, far older than that. You know, you read European history, it goes farther back than that. Or Indian history goes further back than that. But Lord Chaitanya is more recent. So we have Lord Chaitanya, Krishna, and we hear about them, and we chant their names, and then we can directly engage in bhakti yoga. So that's what it means to cause mercy to the devotees who would take birth in the future in this age of Kali. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, act and wait. Simply by remembering him, one will be freed from all the lamentation and happiness of material existence. Because when you're in love, you forget about everything else. That's the point. When you love Krishna, try to serve Krishna, then automatically, by doing that, one becomes detached from the material world. Because detachment only comes about by attachment to something else. Just like I was talking to someone last night about nishkama bhakti, or nishkama, actually they were talking about nishkama karma yoga. So we had this whole discussion, because one devotee said, nishkama means without desire, for those of you who don't know. So nishkama. So one devotee said, you know, he had read some book where it said nishkam karma yoga means that one is doing yoga, or one is doing, is serving Krishna, offering the results of his activities for Krishna, to Krishna, without desire for the fruits, but he has a desire, you know, one devotee was saying that, but he has the desire for liberation, or he has the desire because he's attached to the activity. But nishkam means without any desire. That's pure. Like that, like it's described about Janaka Maharaj in the Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada describes that Janaka Maharaj was engaged in nishkam karma yoga, and he's a pure devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Anyway, so this is the first point here that this Krishna is showing causeless mercy if we simply remember him, and by remembering him we become purified. Ultimately, we come to the standpoint or the platform of bhakti. So the second point here, the Prabhupada makes in his purport, is about the Lord's being equal to everyone. There was a very interesting point that's brought out in the seventh canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. The seventh canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we have in the beginning a discussion between Parikshit Maharaj and Shukadeva Goswami. So Parikshit Maharaj is a little, well, it's not that he's really confused, but he's asking a rhetorical question. Rhetorical means he knows the answer, but he wants Shukadeva Goswami to give him the answer. And he asks this question, why is it the Lord always is favoring his devotees? And why is it Lord's, you know, basically inimical towards the demons? You know, because this is the same point Prabhupada talks about, the Lord is always merciful to everyone, whether it's a demon or a devotee, right? So the question is raised, you know, why is the Lord partial? And then Shukadeva Goswami, in order to answer that, explains the Lord is not partial. That whatever the Lord does, even when it's killing the demons, is non-partiality. Is actually for the best of that particular living entity. In the stories that we read about in the Krishna book, when Krishna kills the demons get liberated from the material world. Now, they don't get pure devotional service generally. They get liberated. That means they get freed from the material world, they go to the Brahmajyoti. If they're mixed a little bit with devotion, like Putana, then they go back to Godhead. Yeah, that may happen. But so Shukadeva Goswami, in order to answer Parikshit Maharaj's question, recites the history. And the history is that Yudhisthira Maharaj, who is the eldest of the Pandavas, is inquiring that why is it, inquired from Narada Muni, there's a conversation, it's a conversation within a conversation. He inquires from Narada Muni, my dear Narada Muni, why is it that Krishna is partial? You know, he killed these demons. Shishupal uses the example of Shishupal and Dantavakra. Of course, this is the whole introduction to the seventh canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, which deals with Lord Nrisimhadeva's appearance and killing of Aranyakashipu. He says he killed the demons, Shishupal and Dantavakra. So how's that equality? And so Narada Muni answers that Shishupal and Dantavakra got liberated. Also, they were great devotees before, but he says they got liberated. And because when someone is a demon means someone who is against God. We described yesterday what demons were. We went through this whole liturgy in the Bhagavad Gita, reciting different verses in the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. When someone is a demon, he says they're meditating more intensely, at least these traditional demons, they meditate more intensely upon God. Just like nowadays you find people writing books about atheism to try to prove that, you know, God doesn't exist or something like that. They're writing books about God. I mean, probably in one sense, and then in a negative sense, they're probably more God conscious than most of us, right? Because writing books to disprove the existence of God. I have not written a book to prove the existence of God, and they're writing books to disprove the existence of God. So they're pretty God conscious, right? I mean, atheists, just to be an atheist means that their life is dedicated to being against God. Wow, that's pretty cool. So they think about God more than I do. Whereas my life is dedicated to God. And so the description given in the Bhagavatam is that their meditation upon God, upon Krishna in this particular instance, is more intense than devotees' meditation. And of course, the gopis' meditation, that's later brought out, because they're meditating on him in transcendental lust. Not really lust, but transcendental conjugal more love. Is more intense too, but so in other words, the point is the emotional content of someone's meditation. This is actually an interesting point. The emotional content of someone's meditation determines the intensity of that meditation. So when we are meditating, the point I'm going to bring out is that when we are meditating, when we are chanting, when we are trying to remember Krishna, which is the goal of life, to always think of Krishna, never forget Krishna, which are the two foremost regulated principles, there has to be an emotional component. That was the point brought out, one point brought out in the seventh canto of Bhagavatam. Because without the emotional component, the meditation is not complete. I was just listening to a class given by my godbrother Gaur Govinda Maharaj, who passed away. And, you know, his classes are quite emotionally, there's a lot of emotional content. Has anyone heard his classes here? And he kept making the point, one has to cry for Krishna, right? One has to cry for Krishna. And even while he was giving the class, his classes were more or less like crying. One has to cry, and you know, so intense. I can't be so intense. It's hard to imagine how he had that. I mean, that was Krishna's energy, great devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I remember being with him. He was an extremely intense individual. So one has to have that emotional intensity to focus on God. The same or greater emotional intensity that the demons have, that the atheists have, trying to disprove the existence of God. We should have that same intensity when chanting the Lord's holy names. So, anyway, so this is the point that the Lord is equal to everyone. There's other verses, too, that illustrate that. What? Samoham sarvabhuteshu na maitresho stina priha. As Krishna states in the Gita, I'm equal to everyone. I don't have any favorites. Actually, another point before we end class. Another point is the reason that Krishna is equal to everyone and not like us is that Krishna doesn't have a material body. That's the point made by Shukadeva Goswami and also by Narada Muni. That Krishna doesn't have a material body. So, you know, because we have a material body and ego, if someone says something nasty to us, it causes us pain, doesn't it? If someone says, you are ugly, causes us pain. If someone says, you're attractive, it gives us pleasure, right? If someone says, you know, you're great. Oh, I'm great. I like you too. And if someone says, you're horrible, you think, oh, you're horrible too. So it's because we have this material body, both subtle and gross, that we reciprocate in unequal ways. And we have certain people that are our family members. For example, we treat our family members better than strangers, right? Like I call my mother every week, but I don't call other people every week. I don't call Gokulendra every week. You get upset. But anyway, I call my mother every week because she's my family member. I'm partial. I don't call your mother every week. That's a better example. Do I? I don't think I've called your mother once on the phone. But my mother I call every week. So I'm partial because of the body. You understand? But Krishna doesn't have that partiality because everyone's connected. Mami Vamsa, Jiva Loki, Jiva Bhuta, Sanatana. Everybody is Krishna's family. Not every body, every entity. You know, every body means every entity. Every living entity is Krishna's family. So, yastu sarvani bhutani, agmane bhunapashati. He sees everyone equally. So, samaham sarvabhuteshu. That's why Krishna can reciprocate yayatam mam prapachante tam sataiva abhajamiyam mamavartmanavartante manushupartha sarvasha. That's from the fourth chapter of the Gita where Krishna says, as people reciprocate with me, I reciprocate with them. I am not partial. Krishna doesn't have to recuse himself when there's judgment. Like in a judge, let's say if a judge is in a court and his son gets accused of a crime. What does the judge have to do? He pulls himself off the case. That's called recusing himself. Or if he knows the person, he recuses himself because he has a previous relationship. But Krishna, because he's not able to see equally, Whereas Krishna is able to see equally, so he's equal to everyone. Everyone has an equal opportunity. He doesn't have any special favorites. It's not that someone is advanced in devotional service because Krishna likes them more. Someone is advanced in devotional service because they decided to give more to Krishna, to love Krishna more. And therefore they get more mercy. I mean, everyone gets mercy, but they get a different type of mercy. Even Krishna's illusory energy is Krishna's mercy. Maya, another definition of the word Maya is mercy. So even the punishment we get is mercy. Just like a good parent will sometimes punish the child, with a spanking or whatever type of punishment. But that's out of love, that's mercy for a child. So Krishna, everything that Krishna does is mercy for the benefit of every living entity. Whether Krishna acts through his material energy or Krishna acts directly, it is all compassion and mercy. There's no question of Krishna acting uncompassionately. Even when Krishna, described in the Bhagavad Gita, puts the demons into lower and lower species of life, never to approach them, that's the teaching, the lesson. That's his mercy too. That's not because he hates the demons. Krishna doesn't hate anybody. Okay, on that happy note, we have to end class. All glories to divine grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.